weeknights from 6
on 2FM. Big thanks to Two Johnnies and Africa. It's Monday, the 11th of March, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up today, Stephen Kelly, Keane Tracy and Niall Moran reflect on a roller coaster weekend of sport. Plus, it's the eve of the 2024 Cheltenham Festival, and we'll be catching up with Ruby ahead of racing's biggest week. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552. We're on X at Game On 2FM, or you can WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200.
Game On. On 2FM.
Now, welcome along. We have a lot to get through today, but we're going to start with our competition because this week on Game On, we've an incredible prize from AXA to give away. You and three of your friends could win a trip to see Liverpool FC women's team take on Chelsea at Prenton Park. It's all part of AXA's Being a Woman Shouldn't Be a Risk campaign. And across 2FM this week, we're featuring stories of women who've turned challenges into triumphs. And thanks to AXA, you could win four hospitality match tickets to see Liverpool FC's home game at Prenton Park against Chelsea on Sunday the 28th of April, plus €2,000 to cover your flights and hotel. For a chance to get your name into Friday's draw for this amazing prize, just answer the following question. Which Irish international is the club captain of Liverpool FC women's team? Text the word AXA, your answer, your name and email address to 51552, and later on we'll pick one person randomly and their name will go into Friday's draw. As always, RTE, competition terms and conditions apply. See 2fm.ie for all the details. What an amazing prize. Definitely one trying to get your name in for, because that's pretty special. We're going to turn our attention to rugby. I'm delighted to say that Keane Tracy is with me here in studio to reflect on what was a very entertaining weekend of rugby, but probably not the most satisfying. Is that a good way to put it, Keane?
Yeah, it felt like the weekend, I suppose, when the Six Nations came alive, really. Just not what Irish people, I suppose, wanted. Although there were plenty of Irish people in the build-up hoping that, you know, Ireland would get a good challenge against England, and God, they got more than that. So, yeah, look, I was over in Twickenham, came back yesterday. It was an amazing occasion, I'd have to say. You know, taking off your Irish hat for a moment. Twickenham's a bit like the Aviva. It's come in for plenty of criticism for its atmosphere over the last couple of years, but I suppose unlike Ireland, England have been playing some pretty poor rugby. It's not that long ago they were getting booed off, but it was raucous at the weekend. And when Marcus Smith's late drop goal went over, it was one of those special moments. Unfortunately, not from an Irish point of view, but they'll have major regrets. Ireland will. They still have a Six Nations title to play for this weekend, but no matter what happens, there'll always be a sense of what if, I think, with this campaign, because there's no doubt that a Grand Slam was there for them, and become the first team to have won back-to-back Grand Slams would have been pretty special.
Okay, so Keane, what went wrong, do you think?
Well, first of all, I think you have to give credit to England. They were awesome. This was, not many people saw this England performance coming, albeit they did get to the semi-final of the World Cup and pushed South Africa pretty close in that semi-final, but I mean, that was played in the torrential rain. It almost kind of was a bit of a leveller. But this was by far the biggest statement performance under Steve Borthwick. So you'd have to give England a lot of credit, which they deserve. But I think similarly enough, Marie, to the World Cup quarterfinal, Ireland just didn't deliver on the big day when it mattered most. And that is really disappointing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's going to frustrate these players a lot. Look, going to France was massive at the start of the tournament and winning in Marseille, but France obviously had the red card. We've seen since how much disarray that the French team have been in without Dupont and after the World Cup. But I think, yeah, like, why don't Ireland perform when it matters most? Like, that is a real lingering question. And I know it was only a 1-point defeat, but all the momentum that Ireland had built up, their game management was pretty poor. They were quite passive in defence. They'll have regrets about how they managed the end game. They were twice in the lead heading into the closing stages and they weren't able to finish it off. They scored two cracking tries through James Lowe, which showed that when they got on the ball, they were able to cause England problems. But only one Irish player hit double figures for carries, which is unheard of, and that shows you how little ball Ireland had to play off. So England did a total job on them at the breakdown. They stopped Ireland getting the fast ball that they thrive with. Their lineout was pretty poor again. The 6-2 bench backfired. So I mean, there's plenty of issues there, but I think the biggest one is that Ireland didn't deliver their best when they needed to.
Yeah, that's and in a way, that's almost the worst thing, isn't it? Mm. Like, it's because it's it's now a consistency with them when it comes to these really big games, and it's probably the hardest thing to fix.
It is, when you look at the quality and the form of most of these players, you know. It'll be interesting to see how Andy Farrell and his coaches would have reviewed it. I mean, for me, it was probably a 7 out of 10 performance, which is probably maybe even being a little bit generous, because I'm kind of going to it from a 6 to a 7 because they scored 2 really nice tries and they were in control in terms of the scoreboard going into the closing stages. But that's not good enough for a team that sets really high standards for themselves. They pride themselves on their accuracy, their clarity of thought, but you look at the try, like the opening try that they conceded, it's a big long kick down the field from James Lowe, which has been a real weapon for Ireland throughout this Six Nations. It was the same at the World Cup, but the chase was so poor. Like, this is 3 minutes, 4 minutes into the game, so you can't have the excuse of players being tired or anything like that. England counter-attacked really well, and it was disappointing that Ireland kicked so much ball to England's back three, because when England named their team last week, Marie, it was a bit of a surprise that they had gone away from the likes of Freddie Stewart, Elliot Daly, guys who are reliable performers and who I would have said were more akin to what Steve Borthwick looks for from his players in terms of being solid under a high ball. They might not give you the counter-attacking threat of the guys who came in like Tommy Freeman, George Furbank and Emmanuel Feyiboso, who was sensational. So it felt to me that Ireland had a kicking game plan but didn't actually tailor it to the players that England had picked in the end, because to me it didn't make much sense to be giving England chances to be counter-attacking. And that's where the first try comes from. Obviously Calvin Nash picks up a heavy injury in the build-up to that, but even before that Ireland were really stretched. So they made a similar mistake in the second half in the build-up to Furbank's try, when Gibson Park kicks to the back three again, George Ford keeps the ball in play, and that to me, you got to be finding touch from those kicks. Obviously a lot of people were criticising Conor Murray for his handling of the end game when he puts the box kick up, but again, if you rewind the clock a minute or two, James Lowe has another one of those kicks where he gets great distance down the length of the field, but you're wondering, maybe you should put that in touch, give the players a chance to get a breather, regroup. Even when Conor Murray kicked the ball away, there was a break in play for the injury to Chandler Cunningham South, which meant that England finished the game with 14 men, which I feel like has been missed by a lot of people. Yeah. That makes it even worse that Ireland conceded the late drop goal and were hit off that four-man.
Should Murray have kicked it?
I think he should have. I was just going to get to that point. I think he should have kicked it. The reason why I think he should have kicked it was there was 90 seconds left on the clock. So the alternative would be to have kept the ball and moved through phases. 90 seconds is a long time to do that when a referee is going to be hot on every single entry to the breakdown. They're going to be looking for an excuse to ping you, basically, because they want to reward positive play. So I think it was the right decision. And I was watching it back yesterday. You can see Jack Crowley is shouting to Conor Murray as well. You can't quite hear what he's saying on the ref mic, but my assumption would be that he's telling him to box kick as well. The problem was, it wasn't Conor Murray's best box kick, and it allowed England to attack from that four-man line-out. But even after that, there's no way Ireland should have conceded as much ground as they did. Again, against 14 men, they think they have a choke tackle on the far side of the pitch. You've got James Lowe running in, who's almost celebrating because he thinks he has the turnover, but he's out of position then, and England go down the right flank and Emmanuel Feyiboso makes the bust down the right, and then all of a sudden you're thinking, wow, Ireland are in trouble here. They get 2 penalty advantages, the second one against Tadhg Byrne, which was going to be a handy kick in front of the post for Marcus Smith, but he nailed the drop goal, and you'd have to say England deserved it, and the Irish players afterwards said the same, and so did Andy Farrell.
Yeah, I think it was very clear they did, but the thing that seemed to really get people was the mentality and the fact that, I guess, there was a lot of people getting carried away beforehand as well. So when this happened, it was almost a bit of I told you so.
Yeah, a bit. Like, there's no doubt that it would have played into the England's mindset. And you heard Ben Earl after the game saying that it did. But that was even more like England were being criticised in England as well. I don't know if they were being called the worst England team of all time, which I think is...
People were saying that, though.
They were pretty poor, but you'd have to go on the evidence that you've seen. They were on the softer side of the World Cup draw. They beat Argentina and they got to the quarterfinal and obviously lost to South Africa. Ireland were on the tougher side of the draw, but you can't take away from the fact that they got to the last four of the World Cup. It was further than Ireland. But if you go on the evidence of what we've even seen from England at the start of our start of Six Nations, their defence under Felix Jones was massively in flux, but they hit the right notes at the weekend. And this was always my fear going into the game. There was a similar narrative coming into the World Cup quarterfinal that, you know, this isn't a great New Zealand team and
yeah.
they're there for the taking. But
who's putting those narratives out, by the way? We need to figure this out.
Yeah, you don't have to look too hard when they're out there. No, but I don't think... Sorry, I'll speak from my own point of view. It's not like an Irish arrogance thing. This Ireland team are very, very good. I certainly didn't buy into the idea that they're the best team in the world. I just think that kind of stuff is absolute nonsense, particularly okay. so soon after World Cup. They're one of the best teams in the world, but there's, what, top four teams in the world can all beat each other on any given day. We saw that at the yeah. World Cup. And England now have possibly joined that conversation. Like I said, they've massive scope now to kick on under Steve Borthwick, because this is going to buy him so much time and just breathing space, because obviously they're going to go to France this weekend, and if they can back it up, then the landscape totally changes for English rugby. So look, it's going to be tricky, I think, for Ireland to dust themselves off and go again, but they have to, because Scotland are coming to town. They obviously lost in Rome, which was even a bigger shock than Ireland losing to England. So they have to dust themselves down, because I've seen this narrative as well that, oh, it's only a Six Nations title if Ireland win it. Like, that is that is nonsense as well. I mean, we're not at a stage where yeah. Irish rugby teams can be turning their nose up at winning a Six Nations title, particularly at home. It is going to be a special occasion. There'll be a tint of what might have been, but come full time, if Ireland win it the weekend, it's going to be pretty special regardless.
OK, well, before we move on to that, let's hear from Felix Jones. You mentioned him there and the job that he's doing with that English defence. He spoke to Claire McNamara.
Felix, I think you're the only happy Irishman I'd imagined in Twickenham. You brought down your native country, a team that's been labelled all week as the best in the world, but England were the better team today.
Yeah, I think it could have gone either way, to be honest. There was, you know, changes in lead. One team seemed to throw a punch and another team would counter punch very well, so... very exciting game. Definitely could have gone either way. So, yeah, we're pleased. But ultimately, you know, we have to go again next week in France, and there's just no rest in this tournament. You just have to back it up now.
Yeah, England had been so written off, but that's the best we've seen from them in some time. Did you see that coming? Did you see that performance?
Yeah, well, you know, I think we try to keep ourselves in our own reality. You know, you're never as good as anyone says you are, and you're never as bad as anyone says you are. It's usually somewhere in the middle. So we try to stay in our own reality and just build upon our performances. And like I said, you know, we won't be getting too carried away. It'll all be about next week for us again.
Yeah, it's quite the scalp, though, isn't it? Any mixed emotions from you, or is it just head down, get on with the job, be professional?
No. Obviously, I'm unbelievably happy for the lads, because the way they have applied themselves and committed. And not lost out, you know, not had any moments of doubt. They just kept their effort levels high, and obviously very happy for you know, Danny Kerr to make a 100th test today, and the way the bench came on and had such a big impact for us. So no, it's all positive emotion at the moment.
You must be delighted to see the sort of work you're trying to do and trying to implement the processes with England, getting some reward for that.
Yeah, definitely still a work in progress. I don't think I've ever come off the field after 80 minutes and been perfectly happy with how everything went. So, and today was certainly, you know, there's many things to fix. But credit to the players, they just kept going right up until the very end, and they got what they deserved.
And remarkably now, you go to France to finish off and you have a shot at the title.
Yeah, I'm not sure the permutations just yet. We'll have to figure that out now over the next couple of hours. You know, again, without trying to get ourselves too carried away, we'll just be trying to build on this performance, and if there is something to chase there in terms of what we need to go after, we'll figure that out and we'll make
Thanks,
a plan.
Felix. Congratulations.
Felix Jones there speaking to Claire McNamara. So what exactly has he done now? Where are his handprints on this England team?
In their defence, I mean, that's blatantly obvious. He is the defence coach. He's trying to copy and paste everything he's learned in South Africa under Jack Nienaber, who obviously did such a brilliant job. Defensively, they were much better. Now, Ireland did unlock it twice brilliantly. Like I said, it's not going to get much airtime, the quality of Ireland's tries, because they ended up losing in the end. But if Ireland had held on, we would have been talking about how Ireland went about beating Felix Jones's blitz mm-hmm. defence. But like, that's how fickle, I suppose, sport is. Look, I thought they were much, much better. They were much more aggressive off the line, apart from those couple of occasions where they got split open. the breakdown was a massive focus for him. Look, you don't have to watch too much rugby to know that if you slow Ireland's ball down, it's very difficult for them to get over the gain line. And like I said, Marie, only one player of the 23 that featured for Ireland made double digit carries, which normally you'd have 6-7 players, you know. So that shows how much on the back foot that Ireland were. And along with Felix Jones and Steve Borthwick, you'd have to say that they outcoached Andy Farrell and the Ireland coaching staff, which is another thing that will seriously rankle, because this Irish team and Irish coaching staff, even allowing for the fact that a couple of key guys like Johnny Sexton, you know, are gone now, are much further down the line than this England team are. So I think Farrell's got a couple of big decisions to make this week, whether he rolls the dice and tries to freshen up the team or whether he gives guys another go.
What are the decisions? Who's he thinking about, or what's he thinking about?
Well, the first place to start is on the right wing, because you had Calvin Ashe, who I mentioned earlier, went off injured very early on with a head injury, and Kieran Frawley also went off with a head injury. He came on and played a full back with Hugo Keenan going on to the wing. So I think the most straightforward thing would probably to put Gary Ringrose on the wing. Now, he's never started a game for Ireland on the wing. He's filled in there on occasion, but that would mean that you'd get three centres onto the pitch. Jordan Armour is another option. I personally think there's value in freshening up the bench, whether that's in the second row or the back row. I thought there was several players in the Irish pack who had a tough afternoon in Twickenham. Joe McCarthy, I think, was one of them. Look, he's still 22 years old. He's learning the ropes. There are going to be tough days along the way, but England and Maro Itoje, I think in particular George Martin, just put a target on his back and really, really nullified him. Whether you have a guy like Ian Henderson maybe to come into the side, and that would help with the line out issues as well, because that's just been a recurring problem even going back from since before the World Cup. I think there's a bit of pressure on Peter O'Mahony, to be honest. Not his finest hour. I think he'd be the first to admit that himself. The yellow card probably compounded what was a pretty ineffectual day at the office for him. I mean, if Peter O'Mahony is in the team, you want, you know, leadership, and you want that line out prowess. Two things that you'd have to say were missing at the weekend. But I'd be surprised if Farrell dropped him. I think, you know, he's obviously the captain of the team. There's a grand slam on the line. Whether Peter O'Mahony is going to be the Ireland captain going forward, there's going to be two tests in South Africa. That remains to be seen, because he might not be in the team come then. Ryan Baird is putting serious pressure on him, and a consequence of O'Mahony's yellow card meant that we didn't get enough of Ryan Baird at the weekend, because he had to wait until O'Mahony's sin bin was over. So there are a couple of changes. I don't think there'll be wholesale changes by any means, but I think a couple would definitely be needed.
Yeah, I'd say that review wasn't too pretty.
No, definitely not. No, their compounding errors was the biggest frustration thing. Like I said, Conor Murray not finding touch, but there was two, three, four errors after that that were avoided. So they're the kind of things that Ireland pride themselves on, all this kind of stuff, which is a bit cliche, being next moment focus, but they lost far too many moments.
Are you confident heading into next weekend that they can get the job done?
Yeah, I am, to be honest. Look, Scotland have a poor record against Ireland, particularly in Dublin. Like I said, we can't downplay the fact that Ireland are going for a Six Nations title. There's going to be a massive response, sold out crowd, Dublin Saturday evening. Scotland have been blowing hot and cold. Like, they're coming to Dublin off the back of a really costly defeat. Like, you think of the situation they would have been in if they'd managed to beat Italy in Rome, with Ireland having lost to Italy. Obviously they narrowly lost to France as well, controversially. So look, they're capable of hurting Ireland, but I would be expecting a massive response from an Ireland team who were going to be hurting with themselves more than anything, because they set such high standards for themselves that this is what we judge them off, which is only fair.
The under-20s on Friday deserve a mention. An amazing finish to the game, but the character and resilience, Cian, was so impressive.
Yeah, you talk about mental resolve and mental strength for a group of young guys to show it was absolutely incredible. They did something similar in France. It wasn't quite as dramatic, but at under-19 level, this team were beaten heavily by France twice last year. So to have gone to France at the start in Aix-en-Provence a day after Ireland beat Marseille, they showed similar unbelievable character to win there. They had a lot of quality players coming through. Look, the 20s have been so successful over the last couple of years. Unfortunately, they don't have the chance to win three Grand Slams in a row, but the Six Nations title is still on the line. They're going to need a big favour from France for England not to win it, because this England team are pretty good, as we saw. But yeah, they're in Cork on Friday night against Scotland, and they'll be definitely confident of beating them. They've had their number over the last couple of years too.
You mentioned Italy there and their big win as well, but just for the rugby nation itself, how big a deal is it, and will it be able to propel them now to the heights they need to get to?
Yeah, I suppose, what are those heights? I mean, you have to be realistic in terms of the expectations around Italian rugby, but what was so pleasing was that they backed up the draw in France, and that should have been a win. Everyone knows what happened with Paolo Garbisi and that missed kick, the ball falling off the tee, which it happened again, bizarrely.
Yeah, at the start. Yeah,
and you see him laughing to himself, so I say he was going, oh no, he really needs to learn how to put the ball on the tee properly. But it was an amazing, obviously, look, an amazing win. It was their first home win since they beat Ireland, actually. What was it, back in 2013, I think. But yeah, like, that was the most encouraging thing, Marie, that the France game wasn't a flash in the pan. They were actually able to, they pumped so much into that draw against France that they were able to emotionally get back up and then beat Scotland at the weekend. And Wales this weekend, I think, are going to be seriously nervous. I mean, if Italy win, they're going to have their best Six Nations finish ever, and I think that game against Wales is seriously winnable for them. It'd be brilliant, look, any Welsh listeners will hate me for saying this, but it would be brilliant for the competition and for the Six Nations if Italy were more competitive, that you didn't just know it was going to be a handy win every time, which it certainly hasn't been for the last couple of games for them.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, I think it would be great. The story that's been dominating the headlines today though, Cian, is not a Six Nations story. It's well, it is, but it's a Munster story more than anything. Antoine Frisch has been called up for France for their squad. We're not sure if he's going to go. Any insight into it?
I'd be very surprised if he's not gone already. Okay. I mean, I don't see why he wouldn't be. France wouldn't call him up if he wasn't going to accept the call-up. I just don't think that's a runner at all. They'd be back in training probably today, if not tomorrow. So I would assume Antoine Frisch is probably there. Yeah, so... first of all, it's brilliant for Frisch, and he deserves to get international recognition. Look, he's found it hard to get into Irish squads because the Irish centres, Gary Ringrose couldn't get into the 23 last weekend. That shows you the quality of Irish centres. Stuart McCloskey's been unbelievable for the last couple of years, anytime he's gotten an opportunity as well. So he played in 2022. So for anyone who doesn't know, we should give the background. His grandmother is from Dublin, so he's Irish qualified. He grew up in France, has played in France. He joined Munster from Bristol. So Munster gave him a 3-year contract when he signed, which is unusual, probably a year more than most fresh signings would get. But that was with the idea that he was going to be here for the long term and that he would hopefully go on and play for Ireland. He said himself that he did want to go on and play for Ireland. So it was a surprise that he got called up for France. They have been sniffing around him. But from a Munster point of view, this could end up being similar, if he gets capped by France, to the situation that they had with Sean Cline and Orji Snyman, because Alex Nankivell, their Kiwi other centre, and they've formed a brilliant centre combination, is obviously a non-Irish qualified centre, and the IRFU don't want two players who are non-Irish qualified playing in the same position. So if Frisch gets capped, I don't think he'll get capped this weekend, but France are going to Argentina in the summer, and the talk is that Fabien Galthié is going to bring a lot of younger guys, fringe guys, going to try and enhance the depth pool. So he could get capped in the summer, which would leave Munster in a very tricky situation. Look, it's not a hard and fast rule, but going on past history, they're going to find it tough to keep him. There's also the obvious caveat that if Frisch becomes a French international, then it's highly likely that he's going to be playing his rugby in the top 14, where the most of the French players play. So look, this is the last thing that Munster want. Frisch has been an excellent signing, so yeah, not good times.
Should he be in the Ireland squad?
I think it's hard to make a case for him right now because of all the other players who are playing well. But one or two injuries, if Gary Ringrose was injured and if Robbie Henshaw was injured, you'd need another 13. And Frisch is obviously an out-and-out 13, and he could definitely be in the squad then. I suppose Munster would probably be frustrated that, my understanding is, he hasn't even been in around squads apart from the Emerging Ireland squad in 2022, where he played three times in South Africa. He hasn't even been in an extended squad, so he hasn't been brought in to maybe even feel the love a little bit, and that would probably frustrate Munster. But I think Andy Farrell is a pretty fair selector, and like I said, when you look at the quality of centres that Ireland have, it's hard to say that, you know, Andy Farrell or the RFU have dropped the ball here. You also don't want to be handing out caps, you know, willy-nilly, and Farrell definitely doesn't do that. I know, like, obviously you had the lot of talk in football with Declan Rice and Jack Grealish, oh, you know, we should have capped these players and then captured them. I don't think that's the route you want to go down either. Like, guys want, you know, you want guys to play for the country. So it's definitely one to watch. Like I said, I don't think Frisch will get capped against
England. But once he's gone in,
he's going to be in the French system, yeah, for sure. Yeah. And you'd imagine they're going to be eyeing him up, like I said, for the summer. So that's going to cause Munster complications down the line, in a position where, like I said, Nankivell and Frisch have developed a seriously good partnership that looks like it could only get better. So he's contracted until next year as well, but whether he gets capped and that complicates it and he does end up moving sooner than that, we'll have to wait and see.
And just finally, is it abnormal for them to take somebody that's not playing the rugby in France?
Yeah, most it's very, this French system is very similar to the Irish system. The players generally play in France so that they can have more control over them. So that's what I mean. If he ends up getting capped, is there going to be a clause in his contract that allows him to get back a year sooner? Will he be allowed to play in Munster next season and still be involved with the French squad? It's also worth mentioning, Marie, that he is quite far down the French pecking order in terms of centres. He's probably sixth or seventh choice. The reason he's getting called in is because Jonathan Danty is suspended and they have another couple of injury doubts. France have a couple of really talented centres coming through. One who played at the weekend, Nicolas Despotier. Gaëtan is another talented centre that they have, so it's not a foregone conclusion that Antoine Frisch, Freudian slip, is going to end up winning a hatful of French caps either. But okay, because they have a few injuries, it makes sense to get them in. And the irony is, if Ireland had a couple of injuries, he's not too far from getting a call up either.
Right, it's not a great situation for Ireland, that's for sure, for Munster. Okay, we're going to take a break, Ian. Thank you as always for coming in. Stay with us though, because we'll be chatting to Ruby at Cheltenham after these.
2FM.
Game on.
Racing.
Now, welcome back. It is the evening before the start of Cheltenham, and I'm delighted to say that Ruby Walsh has found the time to fit us in what is undoubtedly a very busy time for you. Ruby, how are you?
I'm great, Marie. Yeah, it's busy here in Cheltenham, but I suppose, Marie, it's all excitement today. Nobody's lost yet. Nobody's been disappointed. So, yeah, great excitement around the place today.
And what's the story then? When did all of Willie Mullins' horses go over, and what are they at right now?
So the horses that were running on Tuesday all left on Saturday morning, Marie. So they were here in Cheltenham on Saturday afternoon, and then Wednesday's runners left on Sunday, and this morning all the horses for Thursday and Friday left, but they didn't come to Cheltenham. They go to Liverpool first, so they'll be in Liverpool for the next couple of nights up there, and they'll come down the day before racing, because there's only a certain amount of stables in Cheltenham. So until Tuesday's and Wednesday's runners have been on the track and leave to go home, there's not enough stables for them in Cheltenham, so they won't be in until Wednesday night and Thursday night. But the ones that are here look great, and they all exercised this morning. They didn't do too much, but they do look well, and Willie's very happy with them all, and Paul is fairly happy as well, so no bad news, Marie.
Oh, that's good. I was looking at a few of them, all right, on the course. Can they just go out whenever they want, or do you get a time slot?
They go out in the morning. So there's no racing today, so there's no real restriction today. But say tomorrow morning, obviously, with racing starting, crowds, public, etc., you have to be off the gallops by 10:30 a.m. So we have, or Willie has, the guts of 47 or 8 horses here. So that's two full lots. So the first bunch will pull out at 7:45, and the second bunch will pull out at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. So yeah, busy for the staff. A lot of walking. It's hard. Cheltenham's a hard place on stable staff. I was even watching Willie's horses this afternoon. They all came down through the race course around the parade ring, and they walked all the way down to the start of the 2 mile, the very end of the track, and walked all the way back up. Now, being led, not being ridden. So if you wanted to get your steps in and lose a few pounds, definitely working for Willie Mullins would be a good job for you this week.
Getting all the logistics questions answered here. So what did you get up to for the day?
So I was doing a bit for Racing TV this morning, Marie. Then I had to go to, not had to, I was invited to a lunch. It was the 100th year of the Gold Cup. So as having won a Gold Cup, I was invited to lunch along with everybody else that won one, which was really nice. Got to meet people that I hadn't seen in years and people I had never met. But yeah, that was really nice. So we had a bit of lunch and did a little bit of work for ITV, and now I'm here talking to you.
I'd imagine there was a lot of people in the know at that lunch as well. Did you get any good info for us?
There was, but Nick Luck was actually working. He was doing a bit for Racing TV, so he was going around the room, and by the time he got to me, he reckoned I was the 26th person he'd interviewed and the 24th person that had told him Galopin Deschamps had won the Gold Cup. So I took that as a plus anyway. But no, there's been no bad news. I walked the track earlier as well, Marie, and I think John Poulin, who has taken over here as clerk of the course, he has the course in really good nick. Obviously, we've had so much rain, it's been so wet, but that has meant there's been no frost, so there has been a little bit of grass growth, so the track has recovered from the racing that was on it during the winter, and it looks in great condition, but it will be slow tomorrow. It'll take a lot of getting, and it's dry here now, even though it's not that warm, and that ground will be even harder for horses to gallop on Wednesday. It'll be really gluey, there'll be no life in it. It might have picked up a bit by Thursday, but it'll be soft tomorrow and really hard work on Wednesday.
Given that it's always raining here in Ireland, does that suit us? Suit the Irish horses?
Yes.
Not us?
Yes, definitely. It definitely suits the Irish horses. It actually inconveniences the English horses. I think we train a little differently, Marie. We definitely use slower surfaces than they use in the UK, and our horses are more used to it. So, yeah, I think that is an advantage for Irish horses. But look, Marie, I can remember coming here and the conversation would be how many Irish winners would there be. That conversation is now how many English winners will there be?
Yeah,
and
it's flipped.
They're predicting sort of 5, 6, 7 English winners. It's completely done a U-turn, which is remarkable.
And Willie will probably get the 100?
Yeah, you'd like to hope so. He's five big chances tomorrow. He's plenty of runners in the Supreme, Tully Hill, Mythical Power, Mr. Giff. He obviously has strong horses in the Arkle too, with Gaelic Warrior and Hunter's Yarn and Ilette de Tomp. Stateman looks rock solid in the Champion Hurdle. Lossy Mouth, Gallimarso, Ashro Diamond in the Mayor's Hurdle, and Embassy Gardens in the Maureen Mullins National Hunt Race. I'm sure a race he'd love to win, named after his late mum, but his nephew Emmett might get in his way there. But I'd say Willie would be a lot closer to 100 by tomorrow evening, Marie.
Okay, well, that's a really good sign heading into the first day. So let's run through the big races to start anyway, Ruby. So the Supreme Novices first. I know we did a big preview last Tuesday, but things can change. Your opinions can change, that's for sure.
Yeah.
What are you thinking?
I don't think a whole lot has changed for the Supreme. Paul is obviously going to ride Tully Hill. It's only a 12-runner race. I don't see a huge amount of front runners in the race. The one question mark would be Tully Hill's jumping, but I don't see enough of the opposition going fast enough to test his jumping. I think he'll get away with it. Mythical Power's in really good form as well. The closer it gets, Marie, the more confident I'd be getting about Tully Hill. I watched him walking around this evening. He looks $1 million, and you'd be really happy with him.
Okay, and what about the Arkle then?
Much more open contest. I think Gaelic Warrior is on a retrieval mission. Ilette Tomp has been rock solid, but he's disappointed twice at Cheltenham. There's been a lot of talk, and people, obviously, we're living a data-driven world, Marie, but the people that crunch numbers and put ratings on horses, they're all very keen on Hunter's Yarn, Willie's other horse. I would have had him very much as the third string. JPR won for the English, Calixius. Henry de Bombhead is quite happy with him. And Found of 50 has been friendless in the markets, Marie. He's drifted all the way out to 15-2, almost 8-1. So, I'd imagine he's starting to look like a value each way pick, Found of 50. But you just wouldn't be confident about horses drifting. You'd like to see them contracting in their price, not extending.
And Ruby, I know you said there about lots of people crunch the numbers and that sort of stuff. Do you put any stock in that?
Do I? I would note it, Marie, but no, I don't. Maybe I should have put more in it over the years, but I would note the ratings, but they're only somebody's opinion as well. Mm-hmm. It's not an exact science. It's somebody's opinion of how good a horse is and what the horse is capable of achieving. I don't know, Marie, sir, everyone has their... If you were to have a debate about who's the best footballer in the country, not everyone's going to agree either. And ratings on horses are pretty similar. So, I wouldn't be a number cruncher in that sense.
I suppose you'd be in a unique enough position as well, where you're often riding out the horses, so you'd have a good feel of them.
But even you take your own view on a race and your own opinion on it, the time of the race, how fast it went, the standard of the opposition. You take your own view, and I wouldn't be miles away from what the number crunchers would be getting, but I wouldn't have Hunter's Yarn as high as they have him. I would have him a good bit lower, but look, they could be right.
Okay, so what about the Champion Hurdle then?
It's statements to lose, Marie. But I think Don used the great line the other night when he said that this is an easier race for Statement to win than it was for Constitution to Hill to win with Statement in it. He's definitely the best horse. He's so uncomplicated. I was just watching his races there for ITV earlier. Like he he doesn't seem to have a flaw. He's not flashy. Stateman's almost boring. He just gets it done. And that's what he's going to do tomorrow.
I was going to ask you, who's the footballer version of Stateman?
Who's the footballer version of Stateman? Who's just stands in the middle? Michael Carrick.
Oh, Ruby. Don't know who should be insulted by that. Should it be Stateman or Michael Carrick? But anyway.
He's just solid. Like, he's just okay. Never...
Dependable.
Never dependable, yeah.
Okay.
Who would you go for? Who's dependable? Go on, can you give me your definition of dependable?
I'd go with big Virgil van Dijk. Dependable. But he does have a bit of flair.
Stateman's definitely quicker than him.
Well, he was in a good foot race now yesterday with Erling Haaland, and he nearly got there.
Nearly, yeah.
Nearly. Will it be nearly for Stateman? It was a good game, yeah. It was entertaining. Yeah. Okay, Ruby, the Mayor's Hurdle. I know you're a big fan of Lossie Mouth.
I am, and I have no reason to put anybody off her. She has travelled well. She's eating, drinking. She's doing everything you'd be hoping she's doing, Marie. Paul is happy with her. She'll handle the ground. I couldn't put her off. I couldn't put anybody off her. She's in really good form. And it's funny, like, Found a 50 has drifted hugely in the betting, and the horse Rachel Blackmore rides in this race. Tell me something, girl. She's done the opposite. She was a 25-1 shot yesterday, Marie. She's a short of 12-1 tonight. So there's a lot of people getting behind Rachel Blackmore and Tell Me Something, Girl, and that has resulted in Gallimard Soul, another one of Willie's, drifting all the way out to 22-1. So I'd say Gallimard Soul is starting to look like a very, very much an each way price. But a lot of people jumping on the Rachel Blackmore bandwagon, and Tell Me Something, Girl is contracting in price.
All right, why do you think that is?
I can see it. She was too big a price at 25-1. She was a wrong price. She's now probably the right price, sort of 10-12-1. That's her chance. But she was overpriced, so I'm sure a couple of shrewd people jumped on that.
Okay, so Ruby, anything else then in the rest of the day?
The last is a good race. Now, the last, it's Corbis Cross, Embassy Gardens, and Salvador Ziggy in the Maureen Mullins National Hunt Chase. And I think it's a race that's under a bit of pressure, but this year's renewal, it is a good race. They're good horses, Corbis Cross and Embassy Gardens. My preference would be for Corbis Cross. I know he ducked out here last year in the Albert Bartlett, but he was at least running his race, whereas Embassy Gardens came here last year and he completely flopped. So for that reason alone, Marie, I would be with Corbis Cross.
Okay, Ruby, so just then, overall, your tip for the day?
It's the double, Stateman, Lossie Mouth. It's even money, but it's like this, Marie, if you were getting 100% on your money every time you put it in the bank, we'd all be going a lot better.
Absolutely. Well, I know you're going to be busy, but you will be with us every day of the week, which is great.
I will be.
Very exciting. Looking forward to it. As always, Ruby, thank you so much for taking the time, and we will talk to you again soon.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. We are turning our attention to football after a brilliant weekend in the Premier League. Stephen Kelly joins me now. How are you, Stephen?
Not too bad, Marie. Are you?
Yeah, good. It was a good weekend all round, I think. Although I'm not sure if Pep Guardiola and Jurgen Klopp will feel the same. Who do you think will be happier out of both of them?
I think dust settles and going to Anfield in Klopp's final year, and Pep's not always had the best time going there, coming away with a point, is probably... he'd probably be happier. Klopp felt that they had an opportunity to probably go and win it, even though I know City at times looked dominant, but the second half, Liverpool missed a couple of big chances, Diaz specifically. So I think at the end of the day, probably Pep comes away a little bit happier, even though I know he feels he can win anywhere, but I think circumstances...
Yeah.
That's a good point.
I think the flip side of it, though, Stephen, is that, like, when you look at that Man City team and how stacked they were and how fit all their players are, and compared to Liverpool, that you could probably argue for both. Yeah. But it did feel like Liverpool had more chances and possibly could have won it. Maybe it was a penalty at the end. Maybe it wasn't. What did you think?
Mm. Yeah, it's one of, like, when his foot goes up the home, kind of get, oh, this is a penalty. I think when you see it happen quick, yeah, you think it has to. But then it's the way he kind of tries to hook the ball, doesn't he? So he doesn't kick through him. So I think if his foot goes forward now, I think... There was an incident. Remember McAllister kicked... there was a Tottenham player in the face, and they went and scored the goals, mm-hmm, afterwards, and yeah, it wasn't given. It was a few months back. And I'm kind of like, similar. I was looking back at it, and McAllister kind of followed through on his, whereas Doku, it's a high foot, but he's trying to hook the ball. So I can kind of see it both ways, but if that was me as a Liverpool fan, I'd be raging that I wasn't given. Or so I can see the disappointment in not getting it, but I can also kind of have some sort of understanding to why it wasn't.
It's big time. A lot of people are, and it's just one of those talking points, I think. And maybe if there had been a winner, it might not have been such a big one. But because it was such tight margins, it's came out today that everybody has an opinion on it, and everybody wants to discuss it and analyse it. But it was a good game of football, though. Stephen, did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it was a great. Listen, I think when these teams go up against each other, the quality on display is phenomenal. The level of intrigue, because the way the two managers are trying to figure each other out, and I know they both set the teams out their own way and they don't really compromise in trying to change the style of the teams, but you can tell there's a tension between it, and the both managers are a bit edgy in how their teams are set up, and it's always interesting to see which one has like the chess pieces moved, what they're going to slightly adjust to try and create another thought process, another thinking point for the other manager. But the first goal was brilliant. I think as much as I look back, remember the Trent goal against Barcelona, he whips in for Origi. That's what I was looking at De Bruyne going, that's such a clever cross for Stones to come across the near post. And then it's a Stonewall penalty. So it was a great game. The technical ability on display is wonderful. The pace of the game is played out from start to finish again. Great. And you know, often these games, the two great teams are going to finish up in a stalemate just because they're just cancelling each other out.
So the top of the table, Arsenal, Liverpool and Man City then just coming in a point behind. 10 games to go, 10 game shootout. How do you think it's going to unfold over the next while, Stephen?
I find it very hard not to go City. I really do. I just find it hard not to think that because they've been in this situation before, they don't falter. They know how to see it through. And then you're kind of thinking, well, everything Liverpool have on the lines with Klopp leaving, like, would this be the most special way to send the manager off? And you're going to get players back at a crucial point of the season, the likes of Trent. You know how influential he can be on the side. So players coming back, that will make a big difference. I'm going City just about Pippa. And then maybe Liverpool. But honestly, then I've been to Arsenal and I've watched Arsenal a couple of times, and you know how much I hate to praise Arsenal, but yeah. I have to praise them. They've been wonderful. And even to get through the games of the day, to come back at the end and win that, when they could have let that slip, those points slip up, they just seem to be better. But I'd be interested to see how Arsenal lead from the top. That's different for them than chasing. I think they're a better team chasing.
Yeah, but the other thing, Stephen, as well, is that like, people are just, now Arsenal are obviously in the title race because they're top of the league, but it is kind of this narrative around City and Liverpool. So if they just keep doing what they're doing, I mean, look, who knows?
Oh, no, honestly, Arsenal, the most impressive performance I've seen this season have been Arsenal. Arsenal against Newcastle, after they lost to Porto in the Champions League, played Newcastle in the first half of the game, and is the best 45 minutes of football I've seen for a long time. They were unreal. Honestly, Marie, you're going, and it scared me because I'm thought, oh God, these could win it. These genuinely could win it. Look at them.
And you're not loving that?
No, not at all. I'm watching and going, I'm really worried here because they actually look like title contenders. And that kind of makes me worried for Tottenham's prospects. But they were sensational. And the whole thing of missing a central striker, and that was what was going to be, they'd falter by, they've just put to one side because everybody's scoring for them. So they have players scoring from every position at pivotal moments. Havertz is coming, he's 4-4 now as well in the Premier League. So they're hitting form, and the confidence that's exuding from them and the energy levels are showing is meant. Like, honestly, they're dark horse as well for the Champions League. You're looking at them going, I wouldn't put past them, honestly.
Yeah, look, it's going to be a great few weeks ahead. I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's just this weekend has really set it up now for the next 10 games. Anything can happen, and we will be across all of it. Stephen, thank you so much for taking the time. I know we were short today, but because of the because of Cheltenham starting tomorrow, we're a little bit squeezed for time, but thank you.
I was actually listening to Ruby there, and I was going to say, for the statement horse, I'm going for Mr. Dependable. It has to be Dennis Irwin, no? Not Dennis Irwin?
Yeah, well, look, we're all put on the spot there now. So, yeah, Dennis Irwin would be a good one.
Is that the most Mr. Dependable ever?
You know what? I'm going to be watching that race now tomorrow and thinking of Michael Carrick and Dennis Irwin and Virgil van Dijk, and I'll come back then with a definitive answer on Mr. Dependable, which one a statement like. Stephen, thanks. Enjoy the week of racing as well. I'll talk to you soon. We're going to turn our attention to hurling now, because it was a very dramatic weekend on the hurling front. Niall Moran joins us. How are you, Niall?
Great form, Reid. How are you doing?
Well, dramatic might have been stretching it a bit. I guess I'm talking about the Waterford-Wexford game. Reid, it was the one that was quite dramatic. Although I did feel watching Limerick that there was a bit of drama there, because they just looked like they were going from strength to strength, the depth and everything. It's frightening stuff. How are you, Niall? All good? And did you enjoy the weekend? What was your game of the weekend?
Marie, I know you're short on time here. Game of the weekend, Kilkenny and Clare. Your love, Clare. I thought it was a really, really excellent contest. Look, again, there was a lot of wides. It maybe meant that it might have lacked the real flow of championship in that way. But above all the games, I just thought there was a sheer intensity of it. And again, we saw it there at the end when Peter Logan landed over a monster score, just what it meant to Clare. Mm-hmm. And look, you have to be realistic there. I'm kind of not all for this talk about it's Limerick. I think watching Clare in league, they've really been a team in league. They've found new talent. And on top of that, I think we saw yesterday, even like obviously Dave Stirl was excellent man of the match. Dermot Ryan, again, very accomplished. But I just thought Peter Logan was immense. Again, there's an all-star hurler coming back into form. Clare have found an awful lot, and probably beat a Kenny team that wasn't a million miles off full strength. And I think, look, and all the talk about Limerick, I definitely think the two closest protagonists went toe-to-toe in Cusick Park yesterday. So moving into Waterford and Wexford, again, look, Davey is pulling his hair out. They started off like a house on fire. Again, like I mean, went 6 points to one up, where it looked really, really pacey. Jamie Barron, excellent. And then all of a sudden, again, the third quarter kind of shut down. They conceded 1-9, got 3 points, and all of a sudden the game was turned on them. And again, it's just, I feel sorry for them. They're just lacking a little bit of confidence and conviction, and that can only come, as I said here previously, with a kind of a couple of big wins and more than one win. It's probably a consistent run of victories. And again, look, I know they have to take the beating now. I know the Kilkenny coming down next week. But again, to be trying to get guys back. So as manager of the league so far, you'd have to say Keith Ross, don't we?
Yeah, definitely.
No loss today in any competition. And again, like if you said it there to Wexford people 3 months ago that you'd be down hood or down and still be in contention for league semi-final in what should be an epic against Cork on the weekend coming. So definitely Wexford really made consistent strides. Again, the disappointment of the weekend probably awfully, but look, the nature of it, if they were beaten by 12 or 14 points, a part of me would be more disappointed. I just think when you get a beaten like that, sometimes you do have to write it off, because it's not a true barometer of where your team are at. And look, again, Cork, above any team, will, when you're a little bit off like that, they'll absolutely murder you, you know?
Yeah. I think overall it was a pretty decent weekend. Well, I thought it was anyway. I saw quite a lot of the games. But then I was reading Eddie Brennan this morning, and he was saying that he thinks hurling's becoming a bit of a game of wrestling. What do you think?
Last year I spoke in this about the role of referees, okay, and I know we haven't alluded to Galway and Dublin, okay, and I missed the Galway-Dublin game. I only heard a little bit of it on the radio, Henry Sheffield's comments, and I kind of was of the assumption that he's sending off for horrendous. No, he didn't say that, in fairness to Henry. He said he didn't see it. But, like, again, the sending off, I kind of wheel to take that in isolation. Like, there was a guy who was retaliating to something that had gone on for the previous elements of the game. Okay, and so anybody who's played at a high level, even a high level club, they will tell you what's going on the edge of the square when the referee has his back turned. All right, this is going on 24/7. As a forward, you at some point you will look for protection. The umpire will wave you on and he'll make you feel like a little bold school child. And then it comes a point where you say, I'm going to take this into my own, this matter into my own hands. I think what you saw in Conor Whelan's case was that, I suppose what Eddie Brennan was alluding to was the amount of pulling and dragging that was going on in the Clare game, in particular, I suppose. And look, if I'm a backman, of course I'm going to do it. How else do you want to stop these forwards at times? You have to do a little bit of it. But I'm calling into question the role of the linesmen here. To be fair to umpires, okay, you look for protection from the umpires. They have the best you and the fan in terms of what's going on. But an umpire telling the cornerback, stop pulling and dragging, like, do you know what I mean? It's like asking a Jack Russell to mind your house when you're not at home. You'll make lots of noise, but it's not worth the curse. And I ultimately, I think the responsibility here is not just on the referee, because there's so much going on, it is impossible to catch everything. I think that the linesmen need to, their role maybe has to change. Like, for the amount of balls that might go out over the sideline, that might be disputed, they're minimal, whereas what's going on inside, behind the referee's back, I think you had the presence of the linesmen further infield. Do you know what I mean? Even cutting across, not cutting across the play, but more so cutting across the pitch, I think that you really have a proper deterrent there, because at the end of the day, at inter-county level, it mightn't work at club level, because unfortunately the way things are, referees, you just don't have the number. But at inter-county level, I think having an infield linesman, okay, within reason, I think that would be a huge deterrent. And again, these are the guys best qualified to comment on the laws of the game, and that's not with disrespect to umpires who give up an inordinate amount of time and are still critical to the running of matches. But ultimately, this pulling and dragging will not stop unless you have a presence in around that area. And to me, that's linesmen kind of crawling more infield, not in front of the goals necessarily, but definitely infield.
Okay, Noel, I think it's it sounds like it could be a solution, all right, but it's definitely something that needs a lot of debate, and hopefully will be sorted before the championship comes around, although that's coming around pretty quickly. Noel Moran, thank you so much for joining us. That is all we have time for, but it is time to announce the name of the lucky person, and that's going into Friday's draw for that amazing AXA prize. Congrats to Martina Ryan, who correctly told us that Niamh Fahy is the captain of Liverpool FC women's team. And the good news for everyone else is there's another chance to enter on tomorrow's show, so do tune in. We will of course be looking back on all of the Cheltenham action and looking forward to Wednesday's races with Ruby, so don't miss that. Betty De Silva is up next. RTE 2FM.